Hello and welcome. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft and my name is Andrew Popel. Saturday morning means books, writing and literary culture every weekend on 2SER. And it is that time of the month when we revisit a classic work of Australian writing. The Australian Classics Book Club means I am joined by a senior editor from Text Publishing and an Australian author, and we delve into a piece of writing that is a classic for many reasons, and we often try to look into why it's a classic. This month, the November Australian Classic, is Helen Hodgman's Blue Skies. We are going to Tasmania, and we're going to take a look into what one of my guests describes as a layer cake of ideas. I can't wait to get there, so I'm not gonna keep you around for too much longer. Suffice to say, Helen Hodgman's Blue Skies is a fantastic and thought-provoking book. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft, and we are going to be back with the Australian Classics Book Club after this short message.
2SER wishes to acknowledge the custodians of the land from which we broadcast, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wadumatagal clan of the Darug Nation, and their elders past, present and emerging. We acknowledge and respect their continuing culture and the contribution they make to the life of this city and this region.
You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft, and my name is Andrew Popel. Calendar watchers will know that it is the time of the month where we delve back into Australia's literary history, pull out a classic, and discuss it in the Australian Classics Book Club. Now, joining me, as he frequently does, is David Winter. He's a senior editor at Text Publishing. Hello, David.
Good morning, Andrew.
And I am also joined this month by Danielle Wood. She is the author of The Alphabet of Light and Dark, Rosie's Little Cautionary Tales for Girls, and many other books. She has also written the introduction for today's Australian Classic, which I'm going to reveal shortly. And most relevantly for today, her website informs me she lives in Tasmania, a beautiful southerly isle full of stories. And in fact, welcome, Danielle. You and David are both on site, not far from where this book was sort of created.
Indeed, we're talking to you today from Sandy Bay, and I think Taroona, just the next suburb away, is one of the key locations here.
This is the first book club that we can sort of boast we're on location. I'm going to say I'm crossing to David and Danielle. They're on location. So let's reveal. Today, our final book club for the year is Helen Hodgman's Blue Skies. And before we get into the book, David, can you tell us a little bit about Helen Hodgman, please?
Sure. Well, Helen was born in Scotland and then grew up in Essex, but she moved out here with her family, and by here I mean Hobart, Tasmania, when she was 13. Within a couple of years, she'd left university and had a series of minor jobs. She was involved in the local art scene, and she absorbed a lot of what was going on here and channeled it for her first novel, Blue Skies, which was published in 1976 in London. She'd been living there for a few years, so she would have been, I guess, in her mid-20s. And Blue Skies was really quite a remarkable beginning for an author. It's a very short, very crisp, really quite savage and funny novel. And it got a lot of acclaim from eminent English literary types. And then Helen moved around a bit. She produced five more novels. Jack and Jill is a very accomplished novel that followed Blue Skies a couple of years later, and there was quite a big gap until she won the Christina Stead Award for Broken Words in 1989, and subsequently wrote three Sydney novels in the 1990s. And she has not published any fiction since. Helen is still alive, but she got Parkinson's when she was very young, I think in her late 30s, and she has been really quite unwell for much of her life, and it's a real shame, I think, that not only that she hasn't produced more fiction, but that the six novels that she has published over her life have not been given more acclaim. I think that she's a very fresh, very distinctive writer who has used Australian settings to produce novels that connect with many, many other Australian novels that we know, but are not like any of them.
I'm really excited to get into Blue Skies. But what I'm going to do before we begin discussing it is just pop a bit of a content warning on today's show, because in the book club, we will be coming to discussions of mental health issues and suicide. So if this concerns anyone, you may want to tune out, and please know that you can get help anytime through Lifeline on 131114. So now let's discuss Blue Skies. And as David has mentioned, Blue Skies delivers the reader to 1960s Tasmanian suburbia. We're in the second to last house of a long line of prosperous weatherboard bungalows, and a young mother waits out her days in a state of perpetual 3 o'clock. The sameness of the days and weeks is punctuated only by Tuesdays, when she dines with a notorious restaurateur, and Thursdays, when she visits a scandalous artist. Next door, her new neighbour from the mainland battles the elements to make a lawn grow, a transplant on a land that is being cleared of native life. Danielle, David, I had to kind of work quite hard on that synopsis to adequately feel like I dealt with Blue Skies' ephemeral narrative and its sense of encroaching doom. I love this book, but I really need both of you to help me understand why.
Well, I think you did a great job of the synopsis there, Andrew, because I would want to read that novel. You can read this book in lots of different ways. You could read it as a critique of marriage. You could read it as a book about postnatal depression. You could read it as a real critique of its time, that sort of late 1960s consumerism. But I read it very much in the last way that you talked about the idea of a world that's still being denuded of its indigenous elements. So I think that's the overarching shape of the novel. When you look at the beginning and its rather surprising end, I think that those two things take us to that being the very heart of the novel. So it's a real layer cake, this novel. You can keep going down through the layers, but I think that bottom layer is the one that holds it all together.
Yeah. It's a really startling introduction when we think about the whole context of the novel. We have our unnamed narrator discussing her view from her house, which was the last in the row of bungalows, and then this other house goes up and she has to watch her bush view disappear. And as we learn more, we see that idea contrasted with the way the indigenous inhabitants of Tasmania have been murdered, have been cleared from the island, and this gradual encroachment of suburbia, which doesn't receive much praise from the narrator in her experience of it.
There's a really, really graphic scene where this young mother who, she's wrestling with some kind of postnatal depression, but it comes to take on a much more global feel than just a personal experience. So there's a really graphic scene where she is imagining the world, or her small part of the world, as if she's looking at it from the sky, and she's seeing this tableau of colonial violence. And I think that's one of the most striking moments. So this book marries, a really quotidian experience of being a young mother stuck at home with a screaming baby, and this perpetual heat of the 3 o'clock in the afternoon, with this really global view of what's happening in her island home.
You've mentioned there, Danielle, though, a couple of different the layer cake that is Blue Skies, and I found myself drifting between these perspectives, and really, I loved this book, the way it just kept bringing ideas up for me. And I'm very conscious, as I am whenever I read one of the text classics, of trying to separate my contemporary perspectives from the way the book may have been received and the way the book may have been written. Do you have a sense, Danielle, being a Tasmanian, of the attitudes that would have greeted Blue Skies on its publication?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about this book is some of the early reviews that turned up in newspapers both here and overseas. So it was reviewed very well in England, where it won a prize, a significant prize, the Somerset Maugham Award. And over there, it was really seen as a critique of ugly Australia. So it was seen very much in the vein of Barry Humphrey's work of Damed and Everidge drawing attention just how vulgar Australian culture is. So that was how the English were receiving it. And they were also very big on plastering the word incest on this book, even though it's such an incredibly, virtually a throwaway line in the book. But because that's what people tend to know about Tasmania, oh, you know, incest capital of Australia. So it was characterised in some pretty wild ways in those sorts of reviews overseas. But back here at a time where, you know, there was immense cultural cringe, the book was reported as, you know, local writer wins international award. So she was sort of being claimed as a Tasmanian, Helen Hodgman was being claimed as a Tasmanian, even though she was born in Scotland and, you know, migrated here as a young person. It was seen as this, you know, Tassie takes on the world and wins kind of story. So it really depended where you were, how this book was received.
Well, that's a great Australian tradition to just claim anything that happens to be on a patch of dirt and as soon as it wins an award. So there was really no sense locally that this book was in any way controversial or was dealing with issues that might be of interest to the wider society.
Well, I'm not young, but I'm glad to be able to say that I'm not so old that I was alive for the reception of the book. But I think that from what I've learned, there was definitely some offence taken, mainly because Helen Hodgman didn't really bother to cover up the some of the local identities who might figure in the narrative. Mm. So I think there was some pretty direct character portraits, and so there was probably societal offence. Mm. I suspect that the deeper issues in the book are motherhood and postnatal depression, the stultifying nature of suburbia, what was done to people who were first in this place, that probably wasn't such an issue. I think it's useful to know that this book probably had a bigger and better life in Australia in its subsequent republication as a Virago classic. It was paired with Jack and Jill, the second novel, which is also very short. So they made one kind of regular length book and they were put into those, everyone would have seen them, those green paperbacks that Virago pumped out in the 80s when they were really showing that there was so much great literature that had been written in English by women that had not really been accorded proper attention. And it was that edition that was the one that I saw on every bookshelf of kind of middle-class Habartians. And, you know, that was the book, the edition that made me think, what is this novel? I picked it up. It had this funny painting, sort of sketchy painting on the front that I didn't really like. And I knew that there was an air of controversy about the novel. I think it always was slightly scandalous, but I think it was mainly because there were plenty of people alive in this very small place who could say that person on page whatever is so-and-so who lives at such-and-such, and this was considered a little shocking.
And if I can just jump in there, Andrew, I was given that particular edition by a bookseller when I walked in to a Hobart bookshop, probably in my late teens, early 20s, and said, I want to know more about Tasmanian literature. I've just become aware that there is this thing called Tasmanian literature. What can you give me? And the first thing that bookseller reached for was that Virago edition of Blue Sky.
Wow. Now, it occurs to me we are discussing a tradition of Tasmanian literature. We're very obliquely referring to themes and controversies. And Perhaps having given the listener an idea of what happens in this book, because it is perhaps a bit hard to pin down. We have a narrator, she has a young child, she has a very absent husband. I still can't quite figure out why he was never coming home. And she lives her life in this...
I think I can figure it out.
Yeah, well...
I think he may have been very busy young lady.
Am I being naive? Are you saying I'm being naive?
He's working late a lot, Andrew.
He worked late a lot. And she's she takes this matter into her own hands, and on Tuesdays and Thursdays, she tries to move away from this stultifying perpetual 3 o'clock that she describes, the days go seeming endless, and she leaves the baby with mother-in-law, who I'm pretty sure is only ever referred to as mother-in-law, and goes off and hangs out with bohemian scandalous friends who didn't seem that bohemian or scandalous to me. They maybe that's where I live now, and maybe that's the distance of time. But it was remarkable how these sort of things stood up. So she went out. She was clearly someone who was looking to live life and not just be defined by her sex and her ovaries. And this is the beginning of the downfall, as both of her Tuesday friend and her Thursday friend suffer for the fact that they are living a lifestyle outside of the norm in Hobart. And that's the action of the book, but there is so much that occupies the process through that, which I loved. Is it wonderful or a little bit terrifying that this book has so many contemporary resonances, you know, 50 years after it first came out?
I think it's absolutely wonderful. I recommend this book to my students here at the University of Tasmania all the time, because it is and remains such an incredibly fresh book. And what's going on with this young woman? She's so many things have happened to her by accident in her life. You know, she's accidentally married this man. She's accidentally had this baby, and now she finds herself in this strange situation. And so she's finding these little escape holes, and they are a bit like Alice in Wonderland hole. So she disappears off down her Tuesday pathway into the restaurant, which is an underground restaurant. And so here was a guy running an underground restaurant where you could drink. So that in itself made that, a strange and different space. And then her Thursday man lives out of town. He's an artist. He's been back to England, to the mother country, and sort of famously gone a bit mad there and then come back to Tasmania. And he's living out of town in this remote property. And when she goes to visit him, his wife goes off for the day, and he and the narrator get out all the dress-up clothes, you know, the nice laces and velvets and silks and things, and they dress up and, have a pretty sexual time together, and then his wife comes back from work. So, again, it's this incredibly colourful world that she goes into, and it's... Yeah, it is must have been quite scandalous for its time.
And each of those figures who live outside of the row of prosperous bungalows world is in some way in the narrative described or figured around their mental state and their mental health, their crazy, their scandalous. And then there's the really sort of horrific, I found it horrific, trip to the doctor later on where she's lost her Tuesday friend, she's lost her Thursday friend, and she just can't understand this malaise. And the scene lasts a couple of lines where she describes it to the doctor. The doctor says, it sounds like you're depressed. And she says, oh, I suppose I am. And he says, well, that's okay. There's something for that, and writes a script. And I found that terrifying, that was mental health care. I mean, I know also that once upon a time, mental health care didn't exist as a concept, but... yeah, I found, again, looking at the gap of time and the resonances of this narrative were just so fascinating, but as I say, terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, she's living in that foggy world of postnatal depression where she feels incredibly disconnected from herself, from her child. I mean, one of the most shocking things in the novel for me is the portrayal of the baby. The baby is sometimes left outside in the hot sun, is sometimes not fed, the baby is a little girl, I believe her name's Angelica, she doesn't have a presence as a human being to her own mother. She's really just an object or an irritation. So the depiction of that is one at once searingly honest and incredibly disturbing.
The artist's son as well kind of occupies the same space. There's, again, that sort of very, very outside of what we probably typically understand relationship, where it seems like a very open marriage, and his wife is good friends with our narrator, but the son is only ever referred to as the boy. And then following a sort of a terrible scene where police kind of brutally rip up their house looking for drugs, Gloria, the artist's wife, goes into a sort of a despair that ends with her suicide. And then the artist seems sort of hopelessly adrift, trying to understand why it happened and only figuring it in terms of himself. And the boy, his son, he talks about how the boy was taken away by his grandmother. And again, there's this lack of agency or even sort of humanity to the children in the novel.
Yeah, I mean, our principal characters that we're reading about here are all quite selfish people, and they're quite devastatingly drawn. But I don't think that's not what, I guess it's not what I really take from it. I can see that they're, you know, they do awful things or don't do things they ought to do to other people. But really what I get from it is that they're sort of all, they're hopelessly adrift.
Mm.
And all living in some form of existential angst,
yeah.
Because of this world that they've been plunged into, where so much violence has happened and so much horror has already gone before. So it's as if, how do you go about the business of living in this bungalow in a suburb? How do you blinker yourself to make that the real world, when if you open your eyes, the horror of the actual world you're living in is just overwhelming and devastating.
Mm, and it's so devastating for its ordinariness. There was a quote that I kind of latched onto, where this is the Tuesday restaurateur date, and he talks about being so piss awful scared of people, and goes on to say, the really frightening ones are the people who cluster together in the so-called better type of suburb. And the only thing I could think when I read that was, oh my gosh, we ended up electing that person prime minister, and then just the contrast again with the grass-growing neighbour, and when she starts deciding that it's her right to just encroach on our narrator's solitude and offering advice like, well, you just have to pull yourself up and not let yourself go because the men don't like that. And whilst we have awful characters on either side, I can't help but continually feeling sympathy and being right there alongside our narrator and her circles of people just trying, it seems, to survive.
Yeah, and something else that I really love about this novel is just how pared back it is and how beautiful it is. So even though we're talking about all this ugliness, the way that Helen Hodgman writes is she presents you with a world that is so visually striking. So she uses colour in an incredible way. So whenever I pick up this book, I feel a little bit like I'm picking up a very visual artifact, and it plunges me into a very particular kind of palette. So I just want to reassure your listeners that even though, you know, the world we're describing here is quite ugly, the book itself is beautiful.
Mm. I think that's a really good point that Danielle makes, because it's a left wing, certainly a feminist critique, but it's not a didactic book in any way. It's a very painted book. The vividness of the colours is extraordinary, and Danielle points that out in her introduction, that Helen actually told her that it was the shift in the light when she moved here as a 13-year-old from Essex, which I guess is probably pretty grey most of the year, to the sort of brutally bright blue sky of here.
Can I ask both of you then your feelings at the scene? Because I agree how beautiful and vivid the narrative was, and I found myself so drawn into it. The scene where, following Gloria's suicide, where the artist is talking about her final days, and he talks about how she accused him of stealing all the colour from her life and putting it on his paintings. And so pieces of that colour now hung in drawing rooms around Hobart, and she no longer had them, because I was so conscious of the beautiful colour and drawing of the novel. And then that scene just devastated me for what I had felt I was appreciating.
Kind of metafictional, isn't it?
Yeah.
I've never really appreciated that, but yeah.
I think that is a really interesting scene, because I think what's happening to Gloria is perhaps the opposite of, or really different from, what's happening to the narrator.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just to come back to that idea of colour in Tasmania and bright colour in Tasmania, of course, this is a little bit unusual for us in Tasmania to have our weather or our location presented as really hot and really primary coloured, because when you think of Tasmania, you normally think of it in those kind of autumnal dawn and dusk kind of tones, or the wilderness of that sort of Peter Dombrowski's pictures with the very muted olives and blues and so on. So to have Helen Hodgman step in here and say, actually, this place is really bright, it's actually a really different way of seeing Tasmanian place. And it also gives us a completely different take on the Tasmanian Gothic, because most texts that play with those other Gothic elements of delving into the irrationality beneath, you know, the apparently normal and the very isolated protagonists and so on, most of those books in Tasmania are going to take you into a wet, dark, cold, gloomy place, whereas Helen Hodgman puts us under this, you know, never-ending blue sky. So I think you always have to pay attention to colour in this book. So whether it's Gloria's way of talking about colour, or the narrator's way of talking about colour, or the artist's way of talking about it, colour is actually crucial to this, as, of course, you know, the title of the book tells.
And the blood on the beach, which Danielle alluded to earlier, which is sort of the brightest and scariest colour to me, which I think comes quite late in the novel.
Can I just read you a tiny bit, Andrew? This is one of the moments. I think this passage is one of the most important in the book. So our narrator is on the bus on the way out to see her Thursday artist, and she says this: overhead, the high, bright blue sky was stretched tight and shiny between pink-tinged clouds. The road ahead was a shoelace of white dust. The colours were primary, hard-edged, acrylic clear. I scraped myself in my bus shell across the perfect clarity and colour of that day, a bag of white skin full of passionate reds and purples and boiling yellow-green jealousies. If the bag split, those colours would spill out and spoil the scenery.
Yeah, wow. I'm going to have to go back now and reread this, because I'm aware, and you've reminded me again, the very opening scenes, the prosperous bungalows are all vividly painted, and our narrator talks about how they never quite got around to theirs, and the house is littered with those paint swatches that you could get from the paint store, but their house is obviously dun and grey, or whatever fading colour it had been. The colour is so obviously important to everything.
Yeah, this is so, and there's also a very big emphasis in Helen Hodgman. This is one of the things that made her quite ahead of her time. I think she really was always drawing attention to how it feels to her to have white skin underneath this glaring sky. Mm-hmm. So she goes to the Tasmanian Museum and Art Gallery in one scene, and she looks at the art in the museum, and again she sees this pathetic white creatures underneath this hot sun, and that it seems really emblematic to her as part of, you know, the problem of the world that she lives in.
We've come a little bit sort of full circle in our discussion, and bringing to this idea of our narrator and the character's whiteness contrasts with the issue that is in no way peripheral. You're on 2SER 107.3, and you are in the Final Draft Australian Classics Book Club. I want to say thank you first to David Winter. He is a senior editor at Text Publishing, and Danielle Wood. She is an author who has written the introduction for today's Australian classic, which was Helen Hodgman's Blue Skies. Thank you, David. Thank you, Danielle.
Thank you, Andrew.
Andrew, and thanks to you and your listeners for a great year of Book Club. It's been fantastic to celebrate so many impressive Australian novels.
I am looking forward to many more, hopefully, discussions around great Australian novels, David, so thank you as well. I also want to just do a last call out, because we have discussed a lot of really, really deep and potentially difficult issues for people. If anything in this discussion has troubled anyone, you can get help through Lifeline on 131114. Thank you, David. Thank you, Danielle. You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3, where you're listening to Final Draft. I actually have to hand over to The Vulture's Nest really soon. Thank you again for joining me in the Australian Classics Book Club. Final Draft will be back with some of our last shows for the year next week. My name is Andrew Popel. Thank you for joining me for books, writing, and literary culture. I'll see you next week. Bye now.
my mind has just been blown.